quid pro quo corruption. There's no need to take my side in the debate over the scope of the anti-corruption interest to see that the court's merits holding is wrong. Even under the majority's crabbed view of corruption, the government should not lose this case. The importance of the governmental interest in preventing corruption through the creation of political debts has never been doubted. Even in the cases that have construed the anti-corruption interest most narrowly, we have never suggested that such quid pro quo debts must take the form of outright vote buying or bribes, which have long been distinct crimes. Rather, they encompass the myriad ways in which outside parties may influence an officeholder to confer a legislative benefit in direct response to or anticipation of some outlay of money the parties have made or will make on behalf of the officeholder. We have not limited the anti-corruption interest to the elimination of cash for votes exchanges. In Buckley, we expressly rejected the argument that anti-bribery laws provided a less restrictive alternative to FICA's contribution limits, noting that such laws dealt with only the most blatant and specific attempts of those with money to influence governmental action. It has likewise never been doubted that of almost equal concern as the danger of actual quid pro quo arrangements is the impact of the appearance of corruption. Congress may legitimately conclude that the avoidance of the appearance of improper influence is also critical if confidence in the system of representative government is not to be eroded to a disastrous extent. A democracy cannot function effectively when its constituent members believe laws are being bought and sold. In theory, our colleagues accept this much. As applied to BCRA Section 203, however, they conclude the anti-corruption interest is not sufficient to displace the speech here in question. Although the court suggests that Buckley compels its conclusion, Buckley cannot sustain this reading. It is true that in evaluating FICA's ceiling on independent expenditures by all persons, the Buckley court found the governmental interest in preventing corruption inadequate. But Buckley did not evaluate corporate expenditures specifically, nor did it rule out the possibility that a future court might find otherwise. The opinion reasoned that an expenditure limitation covering only express advocacy, that is, magic words, would likely be ineffectual, a problem that Congress tackled in BCRA, and it concluded that the independent advocacy restricted by FICA Section 608E1 does not presently appear to pose dangers of real or apparent corruption comparable to those identified with large campaign contributions. Buckley expressly contemplated that an anti-corruption rationale might justify restrictions on independent expenditures at a later date, because it may be that in some circumstances, large independent expenditures pose the same dangers of actual or apparent quid pro quo arrangements as do large contributions. Certainly, Buckley did not foreclose this possibility with respect to electioneering communications made with corporate general treasury funds, an issue the court had no occasion to consider. The Austin court did not rest its holding on quid pro quo corruption, as it found the broader corruption implicated by the anti-distortion and shareholder protection rationales a sufficient basis for Michigan's restriction on corporate electioneering. Concurring in that opinion, I took the position that the danger of either the fact or the appearance of quid pro quo relationships also provides an adequate justification for state regulation of these independent expenditures. I did not see this position as inconsistent with Buckley's analysis of individual expenditures. Corporations as a class tend to be more attuned to the complexities of the legislative process and more directly affected by tax and appropriations measures that receive little public scrutiny. They also have vastly more money with which to try to buy access and votes. The Fortune 100 companies earned revenues of $13.1 trillion during the last election cycle. Business corporations must engage the political process in instrumental terms if they are to maximize shareholder value. The unparalleled resources, professional lobbyists, and single-minded focus they bring to this effort, I believe, make quid pro quo corruption and its appearance inherently more likely when they or their conduits or trade groups spend unrestricted sums on elections. It is with regret rather than satisfaction that I can now say that time has borne out my concerns. The legislative and judicial proceedings relating to BCRA generated a substantial body of evidence suggesting that as corporations grew more and more adept at crafting issue ads to help or harm a particular candidate, these nominally independent expenditures began to corrupt the political process in a very direct sense. The sponsors of these ads were routinely granted special access after the campaign was over. Candidates and officials knew who their friends were. Many corporate independent expenditures, it seemed, had become essentially interchangeable with direct contributions in their capacity to generate quid pro quo arrangements. In an age in which money and television ads are the coin of the campaign realm, it is hardly surprising that corporations deployed these ads to curry favor with and to gain influence over public officials. The majority appears to think it decisive that the BCRA record does not contain direct examples of votes being exchanged for expenditures. It would have been quite remarkable if Congress had created a record detailing such behavior by its own members. Proving that a specific vote was exchanged for a specific expenditure has always been next to impossible. Elected officials have diverse motivations, and no one will acknowledge that he sold a vote. Yet even if ingratiation and access are not corruption themselves, they are necessary prerequisites to it. They can create both the opportunity for and the appearance of quid pro quo arrangements. The influx of unlimited corporate money into the electoral realm also creates new opportunities for the mirror image of quid pro quo deals, threats, both explicit and implicit. Starting today, corporations with large war chests to deploy on electioneering may find democratically elected bodies becoming much more attuned to their interests. The majority both misreads the facts and draws the wrong conclusions when it suggests that the BCRA record provides only scant evidence that independent expenditures ingratiate, and that, in any event, none of it matters. In her analysis of the record, Judge Kollar-Cotelli documented the pervasiveness of this ingratiation and explained its significance under the majority's own touchstone for defining the scope of the anti-corruption rationale, Buckley. Witnesses explained how political parties and candidates used corporate independent expenditures to circumvent FICA's hard money limitations. One former senator candidly admitted to the district court that candidates whose campaigns benefit from phony issue ads greatly appreciate the help of these groups. In fact, members will also be favorably disposed to those who finance these groups when they later seek access to discuss pending legislation. One prominent went so far as to state in uncontroverted testimony that unregulated expenditures, whether soft money donations to the parties or issue ad campaigns, can sometimes generate far more influence than direct campaign contributions. In sum, Judge Kollar-Cotelli found, the record powerfully demonstrates that electioneering communications paid for with the general treasury funds of labor unions and corruptions endears those entities to elected officials in a way that could be perceived by the public as corrupting. She concluded that the government's interest in preventing the appearance of corruption, as that concept was defined in Buckley, was itself sufficient to uphold BCRA Section 203. Judge Leon agreed, dissenting only with respect to the Wellstone Amendment's coverage of MCFL corporations. When the McConnell Court affirmed the judgment of the District Court regarding Section 203, we did not rest our holding on a narrow notion of quid pro quo corruption. Instead, we relied on the governmental interest in combating the unique forms of corruption threatened by corporations, as recognized in Austin's anti-distortion and shareholder protection rationales, as well as the interest in preventing circumvention of contribution limits. Had we felt constrained by the view of today's court that quid pro quo corruption and its appearance are the only interests that count in this field, we of course would have looked closely at that issue. And as the analysis by Judge Kollar-Cotelli reflects, it is a very real possibility that we would have found one or both of those interests satisfied and Section 203 appropriately tailored to them. The majority's rejection of the Buckley anti-corruption rationale on the ground that independent corporate expenditures do not give rise to quid pro quo corruption nor the appearance of corruption is thus unfair as well as unreasonable. Congress and outside experts have generated significant evidence corroborating this rationale, and the only reason we do not have any of the relevant materials before us is that the government had no reason to develop a record for trial for a facial challenge the plaintiff had abandoned. The court cannot both sua sponte choose to relitigate McConnell on appeal and then complain that the government has failed to substantiate its case. If our colleagues were really serious about the interest in preventing quid pro quo corruption, they would remand to the district court with instructions to commence evidentiary proceedings. The insight that even technically independent expenditures can be corrupting in much the same way as direct contributions is bolstered by our decision last year in Caperton versus A.T. Massey Coal Company, 2009. In that case, Don Blankenship, the chief executive officer of a corporation with a lawsuit pending before a West Virginia high court, spent large sums on behalf of a particular candidate, Brent Benjamin, running for a seat on that court. In addition to contributing the $1,000 statutory maximum to Benjamin's campaign committee, Blankenship donated almost $2.5 million to And For the Sake of the Kids, a Section 527 corporation that ran ads targeting Benjamin's opponent. This was not all. Blankenship spent, in addition, just over $500,000 on independent expenditures to support Brent Benjamin. Applying its common sense, this court accepted petitioner's argument that Blankenship's pivotal role in getting Justice Benjamin elected created a constitutionally intolerable probability of actual bias when Benjamin later declined to recuse himself from the appeal by Blankenship's corporation. Though no bribe or criminal influence was involved, we recognized that Justice Benjamin would nevertheless feel a debt of gratitude to Blankenship for his extraordinary efforts to get him elected. The difficulties of inquiring into actual bias, we further noted, simply underscore the need for objective rules, rules which will perforce turn on the appearance of bias rather than its actual existence. In Caperton, then, we accepted the premise that at least in some circumstances, independent expenditures on campaign elections will raise an intolerable specter of quid pro quo corruption. Indeed, the premise struck the court as so intuitive that it repeatedly referred to Blankenship's spending on behalf of Benjamin, spending that consisted of 99.97% independent expenditures, $3 million, and 0.03% direct contributions, $1,000, as a contribution. The basis for the recusal motion was that the justice had received campaign contributions in an extraordinary amount from Blankenship, referencing Blankenship's $3 million in contributions. Blankenship contributed some $3 million to unseat the incumbent and replace him with Benjamin. Blankenship's campaign contributions had a significant and disproportionate influence on the electoral outcome. The reason the court so thoroughly conflated expenditures and contributions, one assumes, is that it realized that some expenditures may be functionally equivalent to contributions in the way they influence the outcome of a race, the way they are interpreted by the candidates and the public, and the way they taint the decisions that the office holder thereafter takes. Caperton is illuminating in several additional respects. It underscores the old insight that on account of the extreme difficulty of proving corruption, prophylactic measures reaching some campaign spending, not corrupt in purpose or effect, may be nonetheless required to guard against corruption. It underscores that certain restrictions on corporate electoral involvement may likewise be needed to hedge against circumvention of valid contribution limits. It underscores that for-profit corporations associated with electioneering communications will often prefer to use nonprofit conduits with misleading names such as And For the Sake of the Kids to conceal their identity as the sponsor of those communications, thereby frustrating the utility of disclosure laws. And it underscores that the consequences of today's holding will not be limited to the legislative or executive context. The majority of the states select their judges through popular elections. At a time when concerns about the conduct of judicial elections have reached a fever pitch, the court today unleashes the floodgates of corporate and union general treasury spending in these races. Perhaps Caperton motions will catch some of the worst abuses. This will be small comfort to those states that after today may no longer have the ability to place modest limits on corporate electioneering, even if they believe such limits to be critical to maintaining the integrity of their judicial systems.